ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
ABC Cricket Podcast time with your boys, Corbin Middlemass and Ed Cowan, for your Friday. Of course, increased cadence during the Ashes series every Monday, every Friday, and after every day's play throughout the Ashes series. And this week, a little bonus episode, the live show, in case you missed it. You can go back and catch up with that right here on the podcast feed. My name's Corbin Middlemass. I'm back in Melbourne after my quick little trip to Perth and then pit stop in Sydney to see you, Teddy. And now here we are back across the computer screen from one another. Good morning to you, Teddy.
Corb, how fun was the live show? I loved it. Great energy. You were on fire. Great to meet so many people. Beers were flowing. I'm feeling a little jaded. I'm not used to the late night Wednesdays, I must admit. So I'm slipping a little bit.
You said I was in form. You were in fine form. There was no doubt about that. You had a pep in your step. I felt like you even came alive. Not that you don't always bring your best, Teddy, every time we chat, but that was the best of what you had to offer the other night. You're in great nick. So
we're in the entertainment game.
Correct.
Corp, you know? Yeah.
Absolutely. Hey, just to echo the sentiment of what you had to say, for everyone that showed up and for people that listen along every week, I know there's lots of people outside Sydney that would love us to come along and do one in their neck of the woods, and hopefully that opens the door for that. So thanks to Jess Radburn in particular, who we need to thank her for all her work and such support for us, and making sure that we can put something like this on, and taking care of our podcast here on the ABC. To Patrick Stack as well, who gave us a little opener the other night. You wouldn't have got that in the edition online.
Thought he was a comedian, didn't he?
He was informed too. He was up for it.
Yep, Stacky the fluffer.
He could have kept going, I imagine, Stacky. We could have brought him up for an encore, no doubt. To Josh Hansen, who's taking care of our podcast now. To Fletcher Doherty, who's done it for years. He's one of our OGs. It was a bit remiss of us. We should have made more of a deal out of Fletch. I think there's no doubt about that. The other night, he was there. Got to have a beer with him afterwards. To Dean and Naomi from marketing, who are sort of helping everybody make their way in, and had some goodies for us to give out on behalf of the ABC. And to Dennis and to Tegan, from a technical point of view, I did actually go back and listen to it. And sometimes you hear these live shows and you think, gee, the crowd's so loud, you can't actually make out what's being said. And yet our little Madonna mics able to capture all of that. It was loud in the room, wasn't it? There was which was awesome. And yet if you listened along at home, hopefully you were still able to hear everything Teddy and I had to say.
You forget when I just throw out, hey, let's do a live show, that, you know, requires the engine of 10 ABC employees to get it done. So very grateful, because it was a hoot. Loved it. Should we do it again?
Oh, I think exactly the same. Surely we can get another one off the ground, and yeah, it's a whole lot of fun. So thanks for you for coming along, and everyone that was involved.
I'll tell you what is real. Inflation's real. What about the price of beer these days? Oh, I think I'm out of touch. That was. I mean, maybe because we were having more than one or two, but my goodness.
Thirsty group.
It was.
But it was good fun nevertheless. Just before we move on from the Perth test, because we've had so many episodes since that ended. It was only a 2-day test, and we've almost had as much podcast content, I think, as the cricket actually lasted. But I don't know if you saw the Instagram post from the Deputy Premier, Rita Safiotti. So the Deputy Premier of Western Australia.
Actually.
So yeah. Biggest donation in the stadium's history to Food Bank. So charity, schools, women's refugees and individuals in need across Perth. So I loved this post that these are the questions that I'm sure a lot of people forget to ask, as much as we talk about the finances and everything else and what Cricket Australia misses out on. Clearly this is an event where, there's catering that's in place for multiple days, and clearly for probably a minimum of 3 days and potentially four, and yet a lot of that food doesn't go to waste. So that was a sort of feel-good follow-up, I think, to a very short test match. The other thing that came out of the test as well was the pitch rating, which has come through from the ICC, which was rated as very good. So the highest rating a pitch can receive. The rating classifies good carry, limited seam movement, consistent bounce early in the match, and a balanced contest between bat and ball, which is interesting in light of the comments from Ben Stokes about how difficult the pitch was. And, of course, we spoke about Harsha Bogle's tweet about the track and 2-day test matches. What did you make of the rating from the ICC?
Absolutely spot on. That is exactly what the pitch was. It was a fantastic cricket wicket, to which there were a calamity of wickets based on very, very poor batting. It was an excellent test track. And I think I'll say it again. Ben Stokes suggesting it was hard to bat. What he should say is, it was hard to bat, comma, the way we wanted to bat. So that doesn't make it a bad pitch, just because it's not suitable to a certain style of play. Without going over the same commentary that we've talked about all week, there was such maybe 2 or 3 hours on day one where the ball seemed around, but it wasn't prodigious. The new ball's allowed to swing. But aside from that, it was excellent batting. And day two, Travis Head proved that. When he got going, England had no answers. There was literally nothing they could do to stop him. So I'm glad that the pressure of the outcome didn't rewrite any opinion that should be very objective on a pitch rating. So full marks to the ICC.
It does make for an interesting exercise too for David Sandersky, who's the curator at the Gabba. So he has promised a typical Gabba wicket, which is exactly what I think Isaac McDonald said, the Perth Stadium curator, leading into the first test. He was quoted as saying, "We are very lucky in this country to be left to our own devices just to make the best wickets for the game. There were storms in the Shield match during the week between Victoria and Queensland. And as we know about the Gabba, Teddy, despite the storms and the heavy rainfall that happened during that match, within the hour, the ground was quickly mopped up and they were back out there and playing again." So I know I'm one and plenty of other people fearful about the timing of this test match. You can almost set your watch to about 5, 5.30 every day where the storms roll through. And yet they're very optimistic that this will be a typical Gabba pitch and that the weather won't cause too much havoc up in Brisbane next week.
Yeah, let's touch on the weather first. I've never seen a ground drain like the Gabba. You can see 5 inches of water and think, "Oh, let's pack our bags and go to the pubs, fellas," but 25 minutes later, there is not any moisture on the ground and you're back out there playing. So what can happen, though, is in storm season, the ball will swing. So I think it will be a good wicket. They'll probably cut the grass back. There won't be as much grass as what we're used to for pink ball tests, but the ball will swing at certain times of the day and then obviously in the night session. And so it will be a good test of bat and ball. The ball will probably go a bit softer, but you can imagine runs being scored and the ability for England to attack if they're smart with the bat. And for the Australians, you know, this is, I think, a bit of a banana peel test. I said it the other night. I think, you know, for those to leap to conclusions after one test is a dangerous game. England could have buried us in that test match. And it does remind me of the last Ashes series. Let's just go back in time for a moment. They played brainless cricket for the first two tests. There was a draw. They probably should have won that, and then they won two tests. Why? Because they melded their attacking instincts with reading the moments of the game to push and pull, when to move the game forward and when to retreat a little bit and absorb pressure. And when they got that balance, I remember us having the conversation that looked like a team that was almost impossible to beat. Australia didn't play badly in those test matches. England played well. So if they can find that chemistry, you know, let's hope they can for the series' sake. I think this test match poises to be a ripper.
You talked about the issue with two-day test matches and how there's not enough of a difference between the shorter formats of the game. And your old mate, Kevin Peterson, had a tweet during the week where he basically said, "Look, I feel like it's the kind of series that we will get a repeat of what happened with Travis Head, where essentially one player's individual performance will decide test matches." That ordinarily in the longer version of the game, you think, look, longer sample size, it lends itself less to, you know, one standout performance. And clearly the shorter the sample size, the more chance that, you know, someone plays an incredible knock. Do you subscribe to that? That there's a chance that, you know, one player, whether it's a bowler or a batsman, doesn't necessarily have to be someone with the bat again, but there could be, you know, 1 2-hour stint that essentially will decide some of these matches if you know, on any given day.
Yeah, I actually do, and that's why I gravitate to just being mindful of this England team. Because if you go through that team with the bat particularly, if you go through that team, there are dynamic cricketers who can win the game in a session. There are a team that can lose a game in a session. And so,
yeah,
you know, that finding that balance is going to be key. But you think Harry Brook can win a game in a session. Archer or Wood with the ball can win a game in a session. You know, Jamie Smith in the Adam Gilchrist mode can do that.
Stokes, seen it before.
Stokes, seen it before. But collectively, when it all goes wrong, it really goes tits up. And they can hand back advantage as they did in Perth. So hang on to your hats. No one's going to turn away from this one.
I did a lot of numbers yesterday where I was sitting around at the airport, multiple plane delays, Teddy, and I thought I'll just have a little deep dive in this. Interestingly, as much as we sort of hammered England for driving on the up and everything else in the Perth test, and they made a lot of errors with the bat, not one player got out the same way twice. So take that for whatever it's worth. But all six nicked off and were caught either by the keeper or in the cordon in either the first or the second inning. So no one did it twice, but each of the top six were vulnerable to that and dismissed in that that same fashion. So take that for whatever it's worth, headed towards Brisbane. The back page of the News Corp papers today reads, Pat's pinky swear. This is uncanny. After only the other night I said, I listened to Andrew McDonald's full 20-minute press conference, and what I was able to decipher out of that was that Pat's no guarantee to play. And sure enough, fast forward 24 hours, News Corp press is saying, Pat's likely to play. He was spotted at Cricket Central, had the pink ball in hand. He was there with his mate Josh Hazlewood, who was bowling with a red ball. So again, take that on face value. But the report suggests that Pat Cummins will be named in the second test squad, which is expected to be released later today, Friday, as we record this. Coming back, of course, from his back issue. The fact that he comes into the squad and he's bowling with the pink ball, does that mean he's in the 11? Is it that straightforward, Teddy?
That's straightforward. If he's fit, he plays and he captains. And you can kind of see a natural selection forming here where he then rests for Adelaide with back-to-back tests. Hazlewood slips in, pretty good replacement. And then potentially both play or they then alternate for the final two tests. And so Cummins comes in for Melbourne, Hazlewood for Sydney. And all of a sudden, I mean, that's uplifting to say the very least from an Australian point of view to be able to rotate them, but then not have the forced pressure of people are struggling physically but don't want to be rested. When people are coming back like this, you can actually map it out in advance. And so they play alternate tests and Scotty B does his thing, and you keep your fingers crossed that Mitch Stark can stay fit.
Article raises the prospect of a five-pronged pace attack. So obviously with Cam Green and Nathan Lyon missing out. I know you're not big on that. And I also didn't think Andrew McDonald entertained that a whole lot the other day. His quote on Pat Cummins, by the way, was, it's making sure that we're not putting Pat in harm's way in terms of accelerating him too much. So he did sort of, again, reference the fact that we saw him bowling in Perth and that he felt like once, you know, us in the outside world had seen those images, we would think, right, he's ready to go. How come he's not playing in Perth? Let's roll him out there. So I felt like the coach was very much, look, let's pump the brakes. And yet it feels like you put your finger in the wind and believe the report that that Pat Cummins is every chance to play in Brisbane. And by the way, that's still, 6 days away or something. Still got plenty of time between now and then. 43 wickets at 17 with the pink ball for Pat Cummins. So he's got impressive numbers, period, but they're even better with the day-night or in the day-night arena.
Yeah, I think that stat would probably hold for most fast bowlers, it's fair to say. From all reports, those that did see him in the nets in Perth, he gave Jake Weller one of the all-time great shake-ups the day before the test match. He was bowling fast. I think he got through maybe 8 or 9 overs at full tilt. So he must be pretty close.
Have you ever had a nets? So that's a fascinating insight. How do you feel about that as a batsman? Is there a chance that rocks your confidence, or do you feel like that's the best possible preparation? I can't face anyone better than that.
Absolutely, yeah. Best possible preparation. And my last test in Nottingham, it was effectively a bat off with Dave Warner, and Ryan Harris, Mitch Johnson, Mitchell Stark, and James Pattinson were all given new balls, two nets each. Go for your life, boys. Two days out, and if you could walk out of that, like world class bowlers, new balls going as hard as they can 2 days out of the test, knowing that, you know, you batted well, there's nothing better for your confidence. It could obviously shake you as well, but you know, you want to over prepare for these test matches. You don't want to go in with any lingering doubt as to where you're at. So expose it, get better. But ultimately, knowing that you can get through, you know, because the nets are all around you, it can be encroaching. It's very claustrophobic sometimes.
Yeah.
To be able to get through a session like that would absolutely leave Jake Weatherald at, you know, sky high in the confidence.
Have you ever had the inverse? So whether it's at national or domestic level, perhaps some net bowler all of a sudden jumps on top and you think, what's going on?
The whole time, that was the worst. That was because the, like, 3 days out from the test, because they prepare the nets to get through 8 days, basically.
Yeah.
3 days before the test and to get through right through the entire test. So you can imagine how spicy those nets are. And it's a day out for a net bowler. I mean, some bloke from third grade, the Toowong third grade bloody cricket club, turns up with a brand new cherry, big no balls, you know, want to knock over Dave Warner or Steve Smith.
Yep.
So there's no benefit in that. And they swing, you know, a different pace. They're bowling little dobblers that swing around corners. That's a killer. I would have rather faced Mitch Johnson and Mitchell Stark at full tilt than some dobbler 3 days out before a test every day of the week.
He's running the scenario in his own mind about, you know, maybe if I bowl well here, someone will think all of a sudden I'll come up from the second grade of Toowong to get a look in, and the national selectors will think, gee, this guy's a, you know, a player of national interest. And all of a sudden he becomes a pony. You can imagine there'll be a few stories in that category.
That's how far, I mean, I know we're kind of chewing the fat here a little bit, yeah. But you got to remember that's how Farwad was discovered.
Yeah.
So it does happen. Literally, he was bowling in the nets and everyone's like, who is this bloke? He's got the leg spinner, the wrong-un, no one can pick him, lands it on a dime, ended up having a great career.
Fast 15 minutes before we get out of here, Teddy. So Matt Renshaw has called for the retention of Usman Khawaja. If you remember leading into the first test, Usman gave his endorsement to Matt Renshaw as the possible next opener for the Australian cricket team. Despite the fact at that particular stage, I think the incumbent was Sam Constance, and obviously Jake Weatherwood ended up getting the gig. Now, I'm fascinated by this. Is the support for Usman Khawaja support for Uzi, or is it also personal interest? And I'm not saying that that the two things are absolutely exclusive here, but maybe they are the same thing. So maybe it isn't in Matt Renshaw's personal interest as much as he's supporting someone else. It could be dressed up very much as, why would he support Khawaja? He could potentially take his place in the team. When you think about it, Khawaja's finishing one way or the other. That this is ending in Sydney. Whereas if all of a sudden he doesn't come out, not that his words are going to make any difference one way or the other, but if somebody comes in and takes his place, say Travis Head, all of a sudden the next spot that opens up in the middle order, and instead of Matt Renshaw competing with Usman Khawaja and really a short list as the next Australian opener, all of a sudden it brings in Inglis and Webster and the return of Apostle Mitch Marsh and everything else, and I'm not sure that's the scenario that's great for Matt Renshaw. What do you read into his comments?
You just took the words out of my mouth. That I think that's a perfect read. Well, there's absolutely no benefit, play any scenario out,
no,
for Matt Renshaw not to say that.
So it's, you know, one supports his mate.
Yeah, so that's a given. So that's a given. But secondly, the second order kind of flow on is exactly how you've just described it. He needs a spot at the top to be in the team. And so the best way for that to happen is for Usman to slowly evaporate out of that role.
David Warner gave a little insight that his conversations with Travis Head about opening date back as far as 2022. So sort of backs up what Trav told us the other day, that these conversations have been going on for some time with the top brass. And there was a report in the Sydney Morning Herald about Mitch Marsh is in the plans for the pointy end of the Ashes. So the article...
I actually don't get this.
Just quickly, the article goes on to say, if no Marsh in Brisbane, then the Sydney Morning Herald reported that he will be included in WA's team to play Victoria at the MCG. He has not played a Shield match since last October and has not featured in a first-class game since his last Test match on Boxing Day last year. So he was dropped, obviously, before the series decider in Sydney and hasn't played a single Red Bull game in the calendar year. And yet his name won't disappear out of the conversation about possibly having some kind of involvement in the Ashes.
Yeah, I'm just scratching my head. I don't understand this. We've actually got a long list of high-quality cricketers between the age of 24 and 30. We've got a team that we've got one player under the age of 30, and we're talking about bringing back someone who doesn't even play first-class cricket. So, you know, the odds of success of that happening Yes, he's a match winner. Yes, he's a fine cricketer. I'm not taking that away. But the odds of success of that happening are very low. And they're probably lower than having someone who has just played six Shield games coming into the Test team and performing. So he's not bowling. He's not turning out 10 to 15 overs an all-rounder. So it has to be as a specialist batsman. And on what grounds are you thinking as a selector or a coach that that's actually a good idea? Mm. I'm not even on that page. I'm not saying this is the right view. It's just an alternate view. Forget the page. That chapter is not even in my book.
Yeah.
How about you? Like, am I off piste here?
I would be more open to it if, for example, he ditched the beers that he wanted to have on the first day of the test or whatever and went and played for WA in the Shield game in Adelaide last week. But that would show to me there's a real intent here that he wants to do it. And so as much as sort of we're reporting on it and his name won't go away and it's very much, you know, Australia's answer to Bazball and this guy that can flame all over the place, and we saw obviously that dynamic innings, was it Headingley in the last Ashes series? It feels like... we've had a couple of great runs at Mitch Marsh's sort of red ball career, and as you said, it's sort of come back a few different times. But I'd be surprised if we see him again. And I think Mitch is
to open the batting. Is that the idea? Why don't we get the ball? Why don't we get the ball out of retirement? He's playing. He's going to be playing for the Thunder.
Yeah,
that's a joke, by the way.
Yes. I'm with you. I don't understand where it would happen. I think if you look at it, if it is at number six. You'd think surely Webster's ahead of him in the depth chart. And if it's in the middle order, you'd think there's other options that they could go with, whether it's, you know, Inglis or McSweeney or whoever it turns out to be, to come back and fulfill one of those spots. And if it's up the top, it's got to be Matt Renshaw, doesn't it? He's at the front of the queue. By the way, that's completely putting the whole Travis Head conversation to one side, that if they wanted that style of player, you're better off bringing in a middle order player and putting Head back to the top, giving him the opportunity to do it.
Who wrote the article out of interest?
Three names on it.
Three names on it. I mean, why not?
Dan Bredig, Tom Deason, Dan Walsh. And the headline, Marsh firms for Ashes cameo as Ponting declares England incapable of change.
So how does that work? I mean, you're a journalist. How do three people write an article of 400 words?
I'm not a print journo. But there's, I don't know, everyone gathers information, puts a head together and knocks something out.
Mm-hmm. Mm. I mean, there are some decent cricket minds amongst them. I'm going to call Tom Deason ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, he's just reporting, I'm sure, what he's hearing. It's not to say that it's not happening behind the scenes. Mm. Maybe.
That's why I'm interested.
Yes. Now, speaking of good journalism happening out there, Dan Cherney's piece in Code Sports. I don't know if you caught up with this, that the Adelaide Oval will host the first test in the 2027-28 summer of cricket, and the Queensland government continue to lobby to win back the series opener. The future tours program is going to expire, we know that for sure, in mid-2027, which doesn't include the 50-over World Cup as it currently stands, but we know that's going to take place in October-November. It's in Africa, which is the same time, really, that it was held the last time we had a 50-over World Cup in 2023. So there's going to be three test matches that Australian summer against Pakistan and two against Sri Lanka. Now, the three test matches against Pakistan obviously won't even begin until after that 50-over World Cup, which you think by that stage is going to be mid to late December. And given the fact that the featured test matches have to be Melbourne and Boxing Day, Sydney in the new year, Adelaide is actually in line now to host the first test of the summer, which is going to be that pre-Christmas test. The reason for that is they obviously have that long-standing arrangement to lock down that window. So it leaves Perth and Brisbane out in the cold. Perth have hosted the test opener in recent summers, including obviously this year. Brisbane are trying to win it back. And yet at the moment, they look like they're set for two test matches against Sri Lanka at best in the January window when those two tests roll around.
So why don't they move the test matches against Sri Lanka to the winter or some other time and get the Australian players playing the Big Bash? Because
would you rather that, if you're at Brisbane or Perth, rather than having a test match, to have
would you rather
spice
the
up BBL games?
Absolutely. Every day of the week. Every day of the week.
Mm-hmm.
And realistically, if they're trying to sell Big Bash teams, and in 2 years' time, potentially the first year under private ownership, the Australian players are playing Tier 2 cricket against Sri Lanka while the Big Bash is going on, the owners are going to be absolutely furious. So I would put an asterisk over that series.
You could also get funky with the fixture, for example, and you say, look, as a way to compensate Perth and Brisbane for missing out on test matches. How about we stage some of those games to make sure that they get home fixtures after the Sydney test match? So towards the back end of the BBL, for example, when you know the national guys are going to be there, you can fixture the big teams from Sydney and Melbourne, for example, that you think are going to feature a lot of the national guys, make sure they're in town. And then you think about it. If you play two games.
There's 100,000 people in Perth. I'm telling you, 20,000 people aren't turning up a day in Perth to watch Australia play Sri Lanka.
Good point.
So you're getting, for 3 days, you're getting 40,000 more people through the turnstiles.
Yeah. We talked a lot about the finances, the two-day tests, and obviously they'll hope that a lot of these Ashes test matches go time, and there's a good reason for that, obviously, given the fact that Cricket Australia lost $11 million last year despite India touring. You fast forward to what the upcoming summers look like. So it's New Zealand for four tests next year. Following that, it's going to be the one-off 150th anniversary test, which is until March, but England will be coming back to play that pink ball fixture. And then the following year, we're going to have three against Pakistan, two against Sri Lanka. So it's not sort of England and India in terms of numbers, and we're going to have to wait for that. If this is going to continue to be the cycle, and I know a lot of people hope that it just stands still, it's very unlikely that's going to be the case. So I think we're all expecting some kind of dramatic change in the next future tours program. Can we not alternate them? Can we not somehow work it out that we can go, you know, England off year, India off year, for example, rather than going England, India back to back, and then all of a sudden we have, you know, other participants for two consecutive summers?
Yeah, without doubt, there needs to be some examination of that.
The Sheffield Shield, Teddy, speaking of articles, I don't know if you caught up with Ben Horne's piece in The Australian. Talking about New South Wales cricket and the lows of the New South Wales state team. So all of a sudden, one win through their opening five Shield games, and now all of a sudden find themselves second last on the table, a humiliating innings defeat and a 58 run defeat at Cricket Central. First of all, what'd you think of the piece about New South Wales cricket, and in particular Greg Shipard, the coach, and the head of cricket, Greg Mail, under increasing pressure?
I'll come to that in a second. So just a few fun facts. So that was the first result at Cricket Central, I think, in 8 or 9 first-class games. So that was the first one. And I think I read...
Is that a win for New South Wales cricket, or are you trying to take a W there?
No, I'm just saying, it was interesting. It's a hard place to lose at, let alone by an innings, and let alone when you declare in the first innings. So I think it might have been the first time that a team had declared in the first innings and lost by an innings for either 50 years or ever, or there was some fun fact doing the rounds. So on to the question you present me. I'll give a personal view, but just be mindful that I'm on the board of Cricket New South Wales. I think Ben Horne's asking all the right questions. I look at that team, and I think 8 of the 11 on the park have either played for Australia A in the last 12 months, and you add, or Australia for that matter, and you add in some white hot talent around that. You know, Lucky Shaw's played Australia A white ball cricket. Ryan Hicks, who's a keeper batsman, ended up opening the batting, but he's a great middle order player who can keep as well. So there's talent galore. So something must not be right. I'm not necessarily close enough to be able to put my finger on it, but I think they're the right questions. And with that, there has to be accountability. And so I don't know where that lands, but the team has to start winning and should start winning, because it's a pretty good cricket team.
Jeez, it feels early in the summer to be having these conversations though, doesn't it? Like we're not even at the halfway point.
I'm a long term, everything in my mind is always for the long term. So I'm not antsy at all. I'm just saying that there is a understandable frustration around the performance of the team.
Yeah, it feels, from the outside looking in, you would have thought that when Greg Shipard came in, for example, that this was going to be the moment. He lives in Melbourne. He flies back and forth to coach the team. And so you're doing that to basically bring someone in for cultural change and everything else that goes along with it.
He's done a good job. He's done this. This was a team, make no mistake, in cultural malaise a couple of years ago, for a whole range of reasons. So he's done a wonderful job. He's been able to bring through these young players. So I'm not suggesting otherwise. But
the results ultimately,
the results need to come. And you know, they had a win in Perth. They probably should have won in Melbourne. but found a way to lose it. And we talked about that, and then the Test players came back. They lost that game, and they got beaten in this game. So not ideal. It's not the end of the world, but in response to the question, Ben's asking the right questions.
The other results in the Sheffield Shield, Teddy. So Queensland had a win in the top of the table clash over Victoria. Big outing for Xavier Bartlett, made 70-odd with the bat, picked up 4 wickets in the second innings. And Gurinder Sandhu got 5 for as well as the Bulls winners there.
Two swing bowlers, ball test at the Gabba, two guys that move the ball in the air, not off the pitch. So just put a little asterisk around that.
Plus the Renshaw 100, obviously, as part of that, which we've touched on. And then South Australia and WA ended in a draw. They lost the entire first day. It was going to be hard to get a result from that point on. WA with 188 and then 324 on the board, 6 down when that match came to a conclusion. Cooper Conley with 70. We probably should have mentioned him the other night when we're talking about our players of interest in their early 20s. Hilton Cartwright with 60-odd in the second innings. And Jaden Goodwin on his return got half centuries in each innings. And Nathan McSweeney amongst the runs. So keeps himself in the mix, as we like to say, with 68.
The name keeps popping up, that's for sure.
So one round still to come, obviously, before the Big Bash break. Victoria on top of the table. WA had a draw and somehow fell from third to last, such as how close it is, obviously, on the table at the moment. So Victoria, Queensland, Tasmania, SA, New South Wales and WA last of all. The Vics will play WA at the MCG. So this starts on December 4 and then on December the 5th. So the following day, day two of the test match, it'll be New South Wales and Queensland at the SCG and South Australia play Tasmania at Adelaide Oval. Last word before we're out, Teddy, goes to the WPL auction where Meg Lanning got some big bucks here, $325,000. Signed up by the UP Warriors, but the stunning result was that Elisa Healy was passed up. So no takers for Healy, not one of the 10 Aussies to go in the WPL auction.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't catch that news because I think it happened overnight. But interesting, the same thing started to happen with Aaron Finch at the end of his career where he was the national captain but probably declining in skill and fitness. Heels are a hero of mine, so I'm not suggesting otherwise. But when franchise cricket starts not acknowledging what national teams are, they're usually ahead of the curve a little bit.
And I think, like you've said before, that it's becoming a lot like the IPL too, where it's let's get our needs. You're only allowed 4 overseas players. So Alana King, for example, despite how well she's going, she got passed up as well. No Elisa Healy. And yet players, for example, like Lucy Hamilton, who's a left-armer out of the Australian under-19s, she gets a contract and a look-in. Molly Illingworth, who's a quick, out-and-out quick, again, less of those on offer in the subcontinent. As a result, she was able to get some interest as well. So well done to all the 10 players that got picked up in the WPL auction.
The other thing we need to talk about on Monday,
yes,
that we haven't, is India South Africa.
Oh yeah, yep.
Because I don't think we've got the time to unpack it. So put a pin in that. Put a pin in a little WBBL, and we can come back to that.
It feels like when you're talking about the best cricket nations in the world, you always default to saying, India's be in the mix, and sure their white ball stuff's been good, but 5 test wins in their last 15 matches and 2 of them are against the West Indies. There's a bit to pick apart from.
There's a little preview for Monday. I see what you've done. That was the broadcast ring.
It's what we call the tease in the broadcast game. Have a great weekend, Teddy. I will chat to you on Monday.
Love you, Cole. Thanks, mate.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.